just wanted to know what represent the Oka crisis, or so-called Oka crisis, in your point of view.
What it represented?
Yeah, for you.
For me, well, it was like a re-emergence of a warrior spirit and militant native resistance against the Canadian government, against colonialism. And I think it really reinvigorated Native people's struggles, and it set the tone for those struggles all through the 90s and up until today even. Yeah.
And how did you receive this event as a Native from BC?
I think all across the country, like, Native people identified with the struggle that was going on at Oka, because they all had similar disputes going on. Because if you look at Oka, it was just like that, you know, expansion of a golf course and the condominium project or whatever. And these kinds of conflicts are existing in a lot of different territories all across the country. And that was part of the reason why there was so much widespread solidarity with Oka. Like in BC, I think there was the most amount of solidarity actions, blockades and occupations and that with Oka defenders, was a lot of them were arising from the local disputes. Like one of the biggest ones was in Mount Currie with the Lillooet. And their solidarity with Oka was combined with their local campaign there, which was to stop the expansion of the Duffy Lake Road into Highway 99, which it is today. So their solidarity was in part with Oka, but then also to advance their own local struggles. And that was the same in a lot of the blockades that happened in the province here, like local disputes that were, you know, just became part of the solidarity movement.
How did that feel, that change the struggles of the Native people in Canada?
It undermined a lot of the struggles, like here in BC, a lot of the struggles through the 80s had been kind of managed by the band councils. Because in the 70s, you had the grassroots indigenous resistance movement arise, carrying out blockades, occupations, protests, and whatnot. And then through a massive campaign of co-optation from the state, by the 80s, a lot of those types of actions, the blockades and that, were being carried out by band councils as acts of civil disobedience and whatnot. So this is what was happening all through the 80s. You had the Haida, the Nuchanolth, and the Gitsen Wet'suwet'en, probably the primary examples of this. And with the Gitsen Wet'suwet'en, you had the Delgamuukw land title court case that they'd launched. And as a part of their thing also, they were doing these blockades and that. So after Oka, it led to the reemergence of the grassroots Native movement. And so then through the 90s, you had more blockades here in the province that weren't being run by the band councils. And the peak of that, of course, was 95 with the Chapatin or Gustafson Lake standoff.
Can you extend?
Well, you can see, like, by the mid-90s here in BC, there was the Gustafson Lake standoff, where there was, like, you know, almost 500 RCMP deployed with the military assistance, the armored personnel carriers, and all that kind of stuff. And then shortly after that, there was the Native Youth Movement chapter formed here in Vancouver. And the NYM carried out a number of occupations against the BC Treaty Commission, the BC Treaty process that was, you know, kind of just really getting going at that time. And they also participated in a number of other campaigns, like in Chiam, the summer of 99. And then people from NYM Security Force here traveled to Burnt Church to participate in the Mi'kmaq fisheries dispute. And that itself was another development from Oka. And then you can even go up to 2006, Six Nations. Six Nations was a direct result of Oka as well. You can even see it in the clothing people are wearing now, the camouflage combat clothing, the use of the warrior flag, warrior unity flag. These kinds of things are an obvious expression of and a continuation of what happened at Oka.
And some Mohawks organized like a demonstration saying that, on some ways, also 20 years after, nothing really changed for the Native people in Canada.
Right. Yeah, in terms of those local struggles, those local disputes that I mentioned before are ongoing. So there's always a potential for more resistance incidents like that to occur. And that's why the government maintains this huge funding industry for Indigenous peoples. On the reserves, in the urban areas, billions of dollars are pumped into these communities to pacify the population, to get the youth thinking about careers or sports or recreation, anything except defending the land. So in terms of that, yeah, you could say nothing's changed, but certainly there has been a lot of change because, I mean, all those struggles since Oka with their greater militancy, I mean, those are obviously changes, you know, generational changes, a new generations of youth that come up that looked at Oka and the struggles that occurred after that. So, I mean, that's changed. But, you know, one thing is, like, looking at today, the Native movement today, I mean, there's another change that's occurring, and that's the infiltration of the non-governmental organizations, the NGO industry, into Native communities, into Native movements, and as a result, basically pacifying them, institutionalizing them, getting them off the streets and into the courtrooms or into international forums, that kind of stuff. So, I mean, those are all changes.
Yeah, and we saw also those conflicts from these NGOs about the use of a certain amount of violence on direct actions.
Yeah, which is, ironic, 20 years after Oka, a lot of these grassroots, so-called grassroots groups wouldn't even be existing. The grassroots movements that they have drawn into their network wouldn't exist without Oka, and yet now we have these bureaucrats coming out and saying the movement should all be nonviolent and that kind of stuff. But, I mean, that's just a result of the NGO industry infiltrating into the movement. I mean, one reason that they are able to kind of co-opt the grassroots movement is because the grassroots movement is so disorganized and dysfunctional. And that's a reflection of the state of the conditions that Native peoples live under here, the dysfunction, that kind of stuff. So if there was a stronger grassroots Native movement, these NGO bureaucrats wouldn't be able to manifest themselves because there would already be a movement, and the movement would be mature enough to have, you know, developed its analysis about questions of violence, nonviolence, anti-colonial resistance, anti-capitalist resistance. Because if you look at some of these NGO groups, they have no analysis. You couldn't even describe them as being anti-colonial. I mean, they're just reformist groups that want maybe bigger reserves or more money in the band councils or something, but they're certainly not radical resistance movements. And they're able to come in because there is no radical indigenous movement.
How this event, like on a more personal level, affect your life, your personal life?
Well, at that time, from the late 80s, I was politicized. I was involved in solidarity groups with El Salvador. Then I got involved in anarchist resistance movement, and I couldn't really see too much potential in the Native people until Oka. Because Oka, when Natives there stood up and emerged, showing the warrior spirit and the warrior culture and that kind of stuff, then that inspired me to get more involved in Native struggles. And that's when I actually started devoting more of my time and my energy to Native people's struggles. And then that led into 1992 with the 500-year mark of the invasion of the Americas with Columbus and all that, and I just kept organizing until the mid-90s when the Native Youth Movement chapter was established here. Then I started working with NYM, and then participated in all the different occupations, protests, and blockades and stuff like that. So that was certainly an important event for myself, and I think a whole generation of indigenous people.